Hey everyone, and welcome to the Revolution Health Radio Show. I'm Steve Wright from scdlifestyle.com, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of chriskresser.com. How are you doing today, Chris?
I'm pretty good, Steve. Just getting ready to start a little bit of time off, which I'm looking forward to.
How long are you going to be off?
Close to 2 weeks total from seeing patients. So it's been a while since I've taken that much time, and I'm looking forward to getting a chance to spend even more time with Sylvie and Alan and just having some time to rest.
Well, good for you, man. It's well-deserved and well-earned, I'm sure.
How are you doing?
Doing well. We got some new exciting developments over at SCD Lifestyle. We just came out with a new stress product, and we're working hard on some other new products, so it's a busy time of the year for us.
Cool. So you're going to teach people how to get stressed out?
We're going to try to remove the stress from stress management programs, because I have a stack of them that I've fallen off the wagon with, and it just seems like every program that we've bought, Jordan and I, we can never stick with it. And so we wanted to try to strip them down and recombine them into a new product that sort of removes that. And we're looking for people to commit 2 minutes a day, just 2 minutes. And if you can do that, we can guarantee that we'll lower your overall stress.
Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, we hope so. Okay, well, before we get started, I want to let you know that this radio show is brought to you by Beyond Paleo. And if you're new to the paleo diet or you're just interested in optimizing your health, then you're going to want to check it out. It's a free 13-part email series on burning fat, boosting energy, preventing and reversing disease without drugs. So to sign up, go over to chriskresser.com and look for the big red box. Okay, Chris, so we're finally going to get around to the Q&A today, right?
We're going to do it. Excited.
All right, well, let's dive right in so we can get as many in as possible. The first one, and I apologize ahead of time, but I'm going to do my best with this name, is from Algae. And she asked, for someone with SIBO, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, who is following a GAPS, paleo, low-carb, grain-free, sugar-free, and dairy-free, and nightshade-free, and fruit-free, and
nut-free. And what are they eating?
She says she's eating bone broth, some probiotics, and some cod liver oil, but she's not eating a lot of things, things that you've said in the past could make a gut hurt. Mm-hmm. She wants to know how long it's going to take to heal on something like this, because she feels that her tolerance have worsened on this plan as of 7 months ago. She used to be able to tolerate butter and can't anymore, and has to resort to ghee now.
Yeah, this is an interesting question from a lot of different perspectives. Let's break it down into a few parts. So the first question, how long does it take to heal the gut? Unfortunately, there's no way I can answer that generally. Some people tend to respond very quickly to gut healing protocols. I've had patients who have gone from pretty intractable gut symptoms to almost no gut symptoms at all within the space of a 1 month dietary regimen, similar to what she's described here. And then I have other patients for whom it takes years for their gut to fully recover. And the difference, I think, depends on what the initial cause of the gut problem is, whether it's just dietary, diet related, or whether it's related to a gut-brain axis issue or a pathogen or dysbiosis and SIBO or an autoimmune inflammatory condition like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or some combination of all of the above. It also seems to have something to do with how long somebody has had a gut issue. With nervous system problems and the gut obviously being part of that, when we get into a certain groove or a pattern, it can take, the longer that pattern has become entrenched, the longer it can take to set a new pattern. So it's a really broad range, and it just varies from person to person. However, there's another part of this question that's interesting and that tends to come up a lot, which is what happens when you go on a restrictive diet And foods that you weren't previously sensitive to, you are now more sensitive to. The example that she used was that she used to be able to tolerate butter, but she can't anymore. And now she can only tolerate ghee, which has really no detectable casein or lactose in it. And I've heard variations of this question, like somebody starts, they remove gluten from their diet, and whereas they didn't really notice a strong reaction to gluten, you know, after they've eliminated it for 30 to 90 days and they add it back in, all of a sudden they feel horribly ill when they eat it, or any number of other foods that people can be sensitive to. So to be honest, I'm not entirely sure what's happening here, and I'm not sure it's the same thing in every case, because I have witnessed this in my patient population, and I've heard from enough people out in the blogosphere to know it's real. My first thought and my first response to it is sometimes when you're having a number of reactions simultaneously, it's difficult to know what you're reacting to with any clarity. And then when you do one of these elimination diets and then add something back in and you have a very clear, strong reaction, it's just more obvious than it was when you were in kind of a permanent state of reaction. That may be the case with some people, but I don't think it accounts for all of the phenomenon that we're talking about. It's also true that the body is pretty adaptable, and it's probably the case that if you eat something that you react to, you can build up a little bit of a tolerance to it. That doesn't mean it's optimal food for you or that it's a good idea to go on doing it, but it may have some kind of hormetic effect, or the body may have some mechanism for protecting itself against the damage that does, and so the reaction isn't quite as severe. This isn't really the case with allergy, like a true food allergy. That rarely happens, but maybe with an intolerance, it's possible. The other thing is that with an extremely low-carb diet, like the GAPS diet, it really starves the gut flora. And that's a good thing when you're trying to deal with SIBO. But over a longer period of time, I think it can also starve some of the good gut flora. And I have seen people worsen over the long term with the GAPS or SCD type of approach that's very low carb. And I think in certain cases, that may be what's happening, is the good gut flora is getting starved, and their digestion actually worsens over time rather than improves. The truth is, I don't think we fully understand the whys and the hows to the extent that we'd like to with all of this stuff. And that's why I do pay a lot of attention to people's symptoms, and I try not to be too dogmatic about any one particular approach. I know if you go on the GAPS forum and you say, you know, you've been on the diet for 9 months and you're getting worse, and the responses that you'll get are usually you're not doing it right, or, you know, you need to do it more, better, harder, faster, you know, whatever, longer. Because the people, understandably, a lot of the people on that forum have had their lives transformed by the diet. They really believe in it, and they kind of assume that it should work that way for everybody else. But the truth is, it doesn't always. And that's why I sometimes will recommend someone's been on a really restrictive approach like this for a long time and they feel like they're getting worse. Occam's razor would suggest that the simplest explanation might be that that's not the right program for you, and that you might consider adding some foods back in that you had eliminated, particularly starch, and see what happens. And as a matter of fact, I just got an email yesterday from one of my patients who had a very similar story to the questioner here. And she had been on a GAPS diet for longer period of time, probably 18 months, and just felt like she was spinning her wheels and getting worse, and her energy was extremely low. Her digestion was really bad. She was gassy and bloated and constipated and was just having tons of trouble. And so I suggested that she not consider herself on the GAPS diet anymore, that she add some starch back in, and that she actually pretty dramatically reduce her intake of insoluble fiber and plant foods, because when you have a really inflamed gut, a lot of insoluble fiber containing vegetables and fruits like winter greens and broccoli and cauliflower and things like that that she was eating a lot of, and that you most people eat a lot of when they're on a low carb GAPS type of diet, can be really irritating to the gut. So I talked to her, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago or something, and I got this email from her yesterday that said that she was just doing so much better, that her energy levels had improved dramatically, that her digestion had improved dramatically. She had liberated herself from the idea that she had to eat tons of vegetables every day. I suggested that that wasn't necessary because of the nutrient density of all the other foods she's eating, like bone broth and meat and liver and things like that. You don't really need to rely on getting all of your micronutrients from plant food. So now her meals were much more simple. They were just consisting of a portion of protein, a portion of starch, and maybe one vegetable that's cooked well and that's not particularly high in insoluble fiber, like carrots or squash, if she was going to eat winter greens, she would remove the stems and cook them very well, and that has really made a huge difference for her. So it's just one example, but I'm kind of a fan of people not beating their head up against the wall for too long. If they're trying an approach and it's not working, it might be worth trying something different. Now, having said that, of course, that's not to say that someone should do something for a week and then skip to the next thing. I see that a lot too, and that's not an effective way of approaching things. But if you've given it a fair trial, and in my mind, you know, 6 to 9 months is a pretty fair trial on something like the GAPS diet, and you're just worsening that entire time and not really experiencing much improvement, then I think it's probably not a bad idea to try something different.
Yeah, I think it's important to definitely look to change, especially if you've been on something for, like you said, 6 months. We at SCD Lifestyle, this is kind of a plan that we basically try to start everybody on, is something this small. And so we do get some of these emails every week. And so I'd like to share just kind of a tip that I found to be in common for a lot of these people. And it's usually, like you said, it could definitely be that this is just not the way for them to heal. And a lot of other times it's that there's an underlying problem. And you've talked about this many times, like there could be a parasite problem that they really need more testing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other times it's actually a defective digestion problem, like stomach acid. They might have a problem there. And so it doesn't matter how stripped down you strip your diet, if you're not producing the right amount of stomach acid, you're really not going to digest anything very well. Mm-hmm. And so that might be something for her to look into.
Definitely.
Okay, let's move on to the next question, Chris. This one comes from Cecilia, and she would like to know what to do about nighttime leg cramps. Ever since going paleo, I get cramps at night, similar to the ones I would get when pregnant in my third trimester. I've been supplementing with magnesium, natural calm at night, she says in parentheses, and this hasn't made a difference. Any suggestions?
Yeah, leg cramps are tricky because they're kind of a non-specific symptom, which means they can be caused by a number of different problems, and they don't point to any one particular problem without doing more investigation. But in my clinical experience, I can say that the most common perpetrators are either iron deficiency or excess iron, magnesium deficiency, potassium deficiency or imbalance, sometimes B12 deficiency, and then sodium imbalance or dehydration. Low blood sugar, hypoglycemia, or elevated blood sugar can also cause leg cramps. So those are kind of the basic things to think about. Potassium in particular, it's one of the minerals that regulates muscle contraction. So potassium imbalance can definitely trigger leg cramps. That would be unusual for someone to to experience that after going on a paleo diet, usually people's potassium levels increase when they go on a paleo diet because a lot of the most potassium rich foods are fruits and vegetables that people tend to eat more of when they go on a paleo diet, especially like sweet potatoes and yams, pumpkin, spinach, avocados, bananas, oranges, some of the melons are pretty potassium rich, as are mushrooms. But it's a pretty safe thing to do to try and increase your intake of those potassium rich foods, and also supplement. You can consider supplementing with 100 milligrams of potassium a day. In terms of magnesium, I'm Natural Calm, I'm not a big fan of that product. A lot of my patients come to me, people, when I first start working with them, they're taking it and I test their magnesium, red blood cell magnesium levels, and they're low. They still have a lot of signs and symptoms of magnesium deficiency, and they've been taking Natural Calm. So it does seem to help sleep for some people and with constipation for some people, but I don't know that it's particularly well absorbed. And I usually recommend a chelated form of magnesium, like magnesium glycinate or magnesium malate. And those, especially at slightly higher doses, like maybe 400 to 600, even up to 800 milligrams a day, tend to be really effective for leg cramps if they're caused by magnesium deficiency. The you can also take Epsom salts baths. That's another thing that might help, like especially before bed if it's happening at night during sleep. So just soak in some Epsom salt and give that a shot. Check your iron levels using an iron panel and ferritin. So that would be serum iron, total iron binding capacity, unsaturated iron binding capacity, and iron saturation or transferrin saturation plus ferritin. And if all of those suggest that you're iron deficient, then you'd want to eat more iron-rich foods, organ meats like liver and shellfish like oysters and mussels and lamb are the highest dietary sources of iron. And you could also consider supplementing with iron. I prefer using the heme form of iron as a supplement, which is the form that you find in animal products. It's much more readily absorbed than the plant or ferrous forms of iron. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of choices for heme iron supplements. The one that I know of that's most accessible is called Proferrin ES. Unfortunately, it's got some somewhat unsavory ingredients in the capsule, but I think for short-term use, it's probably the benefit is going to outweigh any harm that some of the additives that they put in the capsule might do. There is also iron chelates like iron bisglycinate that you could try, and that has been shown to be better absorbed than some of the more typical forms of iron that you find in supplements. Iron it's tricky to supplement with because a lot of the plant-based forms of iron that are used cause pretty intense GI symptoms. Like constipation is one of the classic symptoms, or just gut pain or gas or bloating. So Ferrocal is a popular brand of the iron bisglycinate. You could try that. And acupuncture actually can be quite helpful for this kind of thing, for musculoskeletal stuff. It's one of the things that I refer people to acupuncture for. So if you have access to a good acupuncture clinic, you might give that a shot as well.
You're doing a big series right now on salt. Is salt sometimes a problem with leg cramps for paleo people?
Right. Yeah, I did mention that before with sodium imbalance and dehydration. So thanks for reminding me. I think it is an issue. I'm not sure that it's a big problem, but certainly if someone has switched to a paleo diet and they're only using sea salt, which doesn't, or very little, or they're not using sea salt. I mean, a lot of people switch to paleo diet and they don't salt their food at all. So getting, you know, 1 to 2 teaspoons, even up to 3 teaspoons of sea salt a day might be something to try as well.
Okay, so start with some potassium-rich foods and probably some sea salt, and then get the rest of that tested. Does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, I will say that magnesium is really hard to test for. Serum magnesium is not an accurate marker. Red blood cell magnesium is a little bit more accurate. It measures the amount of intracellular magnesium in the red blood cell. But frankly, the best way to determine if you have a magnesium imbalance is to take a high-quality chelated form of magnesium like malate or glycinate and see how you respond.
With those chelated forms, I've heard a lot of people with the natural columns will be in like the 800, 1200 milligrams a day. Do you suggest a lower amount and sort of build it up?
I think a starting dose, if you're experiencing constipation or cramps or something like this, would be 200 milligram capsules twice a day, so in the morning and with dinner. And that it usually does the trick for most people. I think it's safe to go up to 800 or even 1,000 milligrams for short-term purposes. But yes, they usually will need less because it's better absorbed than citrate or oxide or some of the other forms that are typically used.
Okay, great. Let's move on to the next question from Ellen. She asks, any thoughts on natural treatments for chronic migraine in a teenage girl? It's been suggested that a ketogenic diet, a la the Perfect Health Diet, could be helpful along with magnesium supplements. Any thoughts?
Yeah, that certainly could be helpful. And I have used that in my practice. But actually, there's something that I try first before I do that. And I think the a paleo primal perfect health type of diet is a great starting place. And so if you're not already doing that, I would recommend doing that. Sometimes that's all people need, but a lot of people often need more than that. So what I do is a low tyramine, histamine, arginine diet. And I'll go into a little more detail about why and what and where you find those in food in a second here. But in, as a general rule, total elimination of all of these foods is rarely necessary, and restricting or limiting them is usually all that you need to do. But I do recommend eliminating them to the extent that's possible for 30 to 60 days just to see if this is going to work for you. And then you can try gradually adding them back in small amounts, class by class, to see which one has had the greatest impact. Because some people, for example, tend to be particularly sensitive to tyramines, but not as much to histamines, or maybe the other way around, or they don't have any issue at all with arginine. So just like any other elimination protocol, you really have to experiment and find what works for you. So tyramines are derivatives of the amino acid tyrosine, and they're present in some foods and some medications. Normally, they're inactivated by an enzyme called monoamine oxidase, or MAO, in the liver and the intestines. And it's possible, some research suggests, that MAO function might be compromised in migraine sufferers, which then leads to excess levels of tyramines in the blood. And excess tyramine in the blood can cause a temporary rise in blood pressure, sweating, nausea, migraine, headaches, and all of the a lot of the symptoms that are associated with migraines. So tyramines are found in primarily in fermented foods like smelly and strong cheeses, like blue cheese, for example, high yeast alcohol like beer and wine containing sulfates, broad beans, brewer's yeast, fermented foods, so like all the dairy ferments and sauerkraut and kimchi, sulfur dried fruits, grapes, preserved meats and fish, and then in some OTC cough and cold medications. So some of these foods, of course, aren't really typically considered to be on a paleo diet, but a lot of them are, and some of them are even very beneficial, at least for people who don't have this issue, like fermented foods. It's not necessarily something that would be done over the long term, and you can meet your need for probiotic organisms by taking a commercial, like an encapsulated probiotic while you're doing this diet. But it's for anyone who's experienced migraines and the suffering that can cause, it's definitely worth giving this a shot for a period of time. So histamines, they occur in food as a result of microbial enzymes converting the amino acid histidine, which is found in all proteins, into histamine. And pretty much all foods that are subject to that kind of microbial fermentation as they're made contain histamine. So this would include all cheeses, fermented soy products, and all other fermented foods like kimchi and sauerkraut, as well as alcoholic beverages and vinegars. There's some overlap, as you probably noticed, between histamine and tyramine foods. So in addition to the list of tyramines that I just mentioned, you'd also want to restrict or eliminate for a period of time things like cinnamon, cloves, cocoa, certain vegetables like tomatoes, spinach, eggplant, and avocado, fruits like strawberries, banana, papaya, some of the tropical fruits like pineapple and mango, and then tangerines and grapefruit. And you can find lists of all these foods online, by the way, if you just Google high tyramine foods or high histamine foods. We're also talking about balsamic vinegar, peanuts and cashews and walnuts, and mustard and ketchup. So what's happening here with histamines is that people with histamine intolerance, and a lot of migraine sufferers seem to have that, have low levels of either of, or both of two enzymes, diamine oxidase, DAO, and histamine L-methyltransferase, and that's sometimes abbreviated HNMT. These enzymes bind to and metabolize histamine. So if you have inadequate levels of these enzymes, you're going to have excess levels of histamine in your body. So in addition to lowering your intake of histamines in the diet, another thing that you can do is take an enzyme, take DAO, diamine oxidase, which is one of the enzymes I just mentioned that metabolizes histamine. You can actually take it as a supplement. And that can improve histamine tolerance and reduce your symptoms. It doesn't mean you should eat a whole bunch of histamine foods and just gobble a lot of DAO capsules, because that's not going to work very well. Those capsules in conjunction with a lower histamine diet can make it more effective. And for some people, they can slightly increase histamine tolerance so that you can eat some of the foods that tend to have higher histamine levels in them without suffering. So there's one product called Daosin, D-A-O-S-I-N. I think Swanson has one. It's one of those things like metformin. It's kind of a patented product that a number of different manufacturers use. It's diamine oxidase from pork kidneys, porcine kidney. And that can help in conjunction with everything we're talking about here. And then lastly, arginine increases the amount of nitric oxide in the blood, which acts as a vasodilator. And migraine pain is thought to be caused by vasodilation in the cranial blood vessels, which is an expansion of the blood vessels, while headache pain, in contrast, is thought to be caused by vasoconstriction or a narrowing of the blood vessels. And this isn't still very well understood, but this is one theory of how it works. So avoiding foods that are rich in arginine can help prevent that vasodilation that's thought to lead to migraine headache pain. And the paleo diet excludes most of the foods that are highest in arginine, but there are two foods that are permitted on a paleo diet that do contain high amounts of arginine, and those are nuts and chocolate, unfortunately. Those are usually the hardest ones to give up for people that are doing this anti-migraine diet. So that's where I would start for migraines. And it's a pretty successful approach. I would say probably 70 to 85% of my patients with migraines experience significant relief. I have some patients who've had intractable migraines for 20 plus years, who've been on all of the medications and, you know, were just at their wit's end, and they've tried this dietary approach in conjunction with an herbal formula that I make for them, that has some foods that help prevent the histamine response, and they're anti-inflammatory and have beneficial effects on the vascular system. So the diet alone, or the diet in combination with herbal formula and the Daosin, the DAO enzyme product, in some cases has completely stopped migraines after 20 plus years of just really debilitating episodes. So it's very effective. I think it's absolutely worth a try, especially when you consider the alternatives. You know, some of the drugs that are used for migraines are not very effective and have a lot of side effects. So I think it's worth a shot for sure.
Yeah, that sounds like a great natural alternative way to see if you can get some help without referring to some drugs. Now, you mentioned that some people can kind of like eliminate them for some time and then slowly add these foods back in. Is that just because the body needs a little bit of time to clear out these byproducts, or?
I think that's part of what it is. It's like, if you think of it like a cup, you know, and you pour water into a cup, and if the level of water is all the way right at the top, then any amount of new water you add to it will make it overflow. But if the water level drops in the cup, then you can add some more in without it overflowing. It's kind of a rough analogy with what might be happening in this situation. But I think the other thing that happens with the elimination diet is when people eliminate all these foods because they don't really know which ones are the most problematic, and then they start adding things back in and trying them class by class, like histamine, tyramine, arginine, but then also even within a class, like within the histamine class, maybe the cinnamon and cloves and spices like that aren't really a problem for them, but certain nuts and vinegar are really problematic. So there's a range of tolerance even within a particular category. And that's the sort of thing that people can figure out through experimentation, which means that ultimately the diet isn't as restrictive, you know, over time as it was for that first 30 or 60 day period.
Okay, awesome. Let's move on to the next question from Judah. What is your opinion on vaccinations in early infants?
I'm just chuckling a little because it's a little bit like walking into a room and saying, what's your opinion on abortion? And then just closing the door and seeing that all hell break loose. I mean,
putting the ball on the tee, man.
Yeah. It's talk about hot button issue in the world of health and medicine. I mean, I can't really think of a more contentious topic, and it's unfortunately there's a lot of hype and propaganda on both sides, and the people that end up suffering are people like this who just genuinely want to know what the science says about it, and so they can make the most informed decision for their as parents. So I do intend to cover this in more detail at some point, but I've frankly delayed doing it partly because of how contentious it is, and it's a monumental undertaking. I mean, you can spend a whole lifetime researching this stuff and still not really feel like you're completely on top of it, and it's just something I haven't really had the time to put together in a series yet. I hope to do it at some point, but haven't been able to. Of course, it is something I've researched extensively and thought a lot about, especially as a new parent. And as Elan was pregnant with Sylvie, I did a lot more research on it, and we came to a decision that we felt comfortable with. But I think the way I'm going to answer this question for now is by sharing a little bit about our process in deciding, and then just kind of a general recommendation that I have for people in terms of making this decision. So the first thing I'll say in that regard is that I don't think this is a decision that can be made based on the data alone. The data are conflicting. There's a lot that we don't fully understand about how vaccination affects the body. There's a lot that we probably will never fully understand, or that it will be difficult to fully understand. And this is similar to what we talked about in either the last episode or the episode before that, about the difficulty doing randomized clinical trials with certain kinds of conditions. Because with vaccination, for example, it's very difficult to say, let's say if you vaccinate a group of children and you want to find out if vaccinations contribute to immune dysregulation and autoimmunity and allergies and asthma and things like that. So let's say you take a group of children and one group of children is not vaccinated, another group of children is vaccinated, then you follow them 15 years later and the group of children that's vaccinated has more higher incidence of autoimmune disease. Well, that doesn't prove anything. You can't say for sure, as we talked about in the red meat study, that it was the vaccinations that caused that higher incidence of autoimmune disease, because there could be a lot of potential confounding factors. Maybe parents who are more likely to vaccinate are more likely to follow mainstream dietary advice, for example, and parents who are less likely to vaccinate are more, quote, health conscious, and they're considering, you know, maybe they have their kids on healthier diets, and there are any number of other intervening factors. So to really find out whether vaccinations contribute, you'd have to do very long, randomized, controlled trials. It would be extremely expensive, and it's unlikely that the pharmaceutical company is going to pay for that trial, right? Because they're the ones manufacturing the vaccines, and they're not really interested in proving that vaccines cause immune dysregulation. So I think the most important sort of meta comment I can make here is that, yes, we can look at the data here, and then we can also look at known and understood physiological mechanisms, ways by which vaccines could potentially cause immune dysregulation. And that's part of the Hill criteria that I alluded to in designing better epidemiological research, is when you have an epidemiological connection or a correlation between two things, if there's also a mechanism, a plausible mechanism that can explain that correlation, it strengthens the correlation. It makes it more obvious, which is why the red meat and cancer connection isn't as strong, because nobody's ever explained why it would do what the plausible mechanism is there. So, when people ask me this in the most basic sense, I tell them you can't decide, you can't make a decision on whether to vaccinate your children only based on the data, because the data are insufficient to lead to a really conclusive recommendation. So that's number one. Number two is that I emphasize to people that there is a risk in vaccinating and there's a risk in not vaccinating. And anyone who tells you differently is not acquainted with the research literature. And that's why I said there's a lot of hype and propaganda on both sides, because you have some anti-vaccine proponents saying that it's completely safe not to vaccinate, and then you have pro-vaccine people saying it's completely safe to vaccinate. And of course, we can easily find examples that disprove both of those statements. There is a risk when you don't vaccinate. There's a risk of your child contracting an acute illness that could even potentially be fatal. And anyone who chooses not to vaccinate has to understand that, because it's a real risk. Now, how big of a risk that is, that's of course a whole nother question. It's something that I'll be talking about in detail when I finally get around to discussing vaccines. And on the other hand, there's clearly a risk with vaccination, and there are studies that have shown vaccine injuries, and particularly vaccines that contain mercury in them. And then there's a lot of, like I said, correlations and plausible mechanisms and other data that point to the distinct possibility that vaccines cause immune dysregulation and can increase the risk of autoimmunity as kids get older. So I will tell you what Alan and I have decided to do. I actually hesitate to do it because my concern is that somebody will, you know, that someone just follow what we did because that's what I said that I do. That's what, you know, because sometimes it's people are busy and it's natural to find someone that you want, that you trust, and just follow their recommendation. But I actually strongly urge you not to do that in this case. It's something that you really, really need to investigate. And I'll recommend a couple of books that we can put in the show notes that you can read. But I just really stress that this is a personal decision. It's something that has to fit with your philosophy and worldview, with your risk tolerance. Like, for example, do you consider very, very small chance of your child contracting a serious and potentially fatal acute illness to be the greater risk? Or do you consider the much larger chance, in my opinion, my interpretation of the data, of your child experiencing chronic immune dysregulation as a result of being vaccinated, a bigger risk? And that's not a rhetorical question. You know, some people, I'm sure, who are listening to this might think, well, you know what? I could not deal with the possibility of my child getting really sick or dying from an illness that they could have been vaccinated against. Now, having said that, keep in mind that a lot of children die from those illnesses who are vaccinated against those illnesses. So getting vaccinated is not a guarantee by any stretch of the imagination that it's not a 100% protection against serious illness or death. And in a lot of cases, the kids who are getting sick and dying are vaccinated. But you have to ask yourself, you know, what are you most comfortable with? And that decision is going to be really different based on someone's worldview and philosophy and approach to health and wellness. So, and I don't have any judgment about that. You know, I have my own opinions and ideas, and I know where I stand on that spectrum, but I don't, you know, we all have to kind of meet this wherever we are and where we're coming from. So at the moment, and you know, this is, Alan and I continue to talk about it, so it's something that could change. But at the moment, we've decided we haven't given Sylvie any vaccinations at all. She's 9 months old now, which is amazing. It was so fast. But she's 9 months old. She hasn't been vaccinated. And the only vaccination that we're considering at this point is tetanus, partly because it's one of the vaccines that seems to have the fewest adverse effects, and it's one of the more serious, and tetanus is a very, very serious illness. So that's our current thinking on it. Again, who knows, we may change our mind, but that's where we're at right now. So to summarize, I think number one, the decision can't be made on the data alone. You really have to consider your own philosophy and worldview and risk tolerance. Number two, please don't make this decision based on what I do or somebody else that you know does. Do your own research and speak to your people that you know and you trust, and really give it the thought that it deserves.
Well, I want to thank you as a listener of the show for sharing that, because I know it puts you out on a ledge to stand there and tell us about your personal life and the decision that you're currently making with your little daughter. So I want to thank you, Chris, and I just want to add on to the doing your research that, you know, Chris is going to raise and feed and all of the reasons why a drug trial cannot really prove vaccinations one way or the other way. There's another reason why it's really important to do your own research and come to your own conclusion, because all the different factors that happen throughout the life as you raise your child will be different. So,
absolutely. Yeah, and I hope this was helpful. I imagine some people might be frustrated and wish that I had gone further into the data, and I understand that. And like I said, I'll do my best to get to it at some point. But it's a really big, big topic, as I'm sure most of you know. And I'll give you a couple of book recommendations, like I said, that can get you started.
Okay, great. Well, let's move on to a simpler question from Rachel. First, she loves the podcast. Thank you, Rachel. And second, of the info that you gave people who are looking or who may need to minimize their red meat intake on one of our past shows, we mentioned hemochromatosis and not individuals with kidney disease. Do you not feel that limiting protein is necessary among this population?
Well, actually, thanks for pointing that out, Rachel. I do think that in some cases that might be necessary. And there are probably other populations that I didn't mention there as well. I was just trying to hit the major ones. In the scientific literature, we could say that a high protein diet is often defined as a daily consumption of more than 0.7 grams per pound per day or 1.5 grams per kilogram per day. And so when we say high protein diet, just so everyone understands, that's what we're referring to. So it's not meat, red meat per se, that it's problematic for people with kidney issues if you're eating a moderate amount of protein. I mean, that's a pretty high protein intake of 0.7 grams per pound per day. So you could eat red meat in a moderate amount, even with kidney disease. And as long as you're not exceeding that amount, then you're not really eating a high protein diet and you wouldn't be at any additional risk for kidney problems. So I think that's the first thing that I would say. The second thing I would say is that there is some evidence that suggests that that people with kidney disease should not eat a high protein diet. There's a big, big trial called the Modification of Diet and Renal Disease Study, MDRD. It's the largest randomized multi-center controlled trial that's been done to evaluate how dietary protein restriction affects the progression of renal disease. And they found that patients with kidney disease that were following the low protein diet had slightly lower, not hugely, but slightly lower decline in glomerular filtration rate, which is a measure of kidney function, compared with patients that were eating the higher protein diet. And then they did some further data analysis that showed that patients with lower total protein intake would have a longer time to reaching late stage kidney disease or renal failure, and suggested that a lower protein intake would postpone the progression into those later stages of kidney disease. Because kidney disease, chronic kidney disease, is classified in five stages, stage one being the mildest and stage five being the most serious with kidney failure. And then there have been meta-analyses of studies on protein restriction in diabetics and non-diabetics with kidney disease that found that the progression of renal disease in both of those populations could be effectively delayed with restriction of dietary protein. But the important thing to take away from this, as we talked about with the red meat study, is you can't extrapolate findings from one population to another population. So just because high protein diets might be harmful in people with kidney disease, it doesn't mean they are for healthy people. I know I've probably used this example before, but if someone who has had their gallbladder removed doesn't tolerate fat and doesn't digest it very well, it doesn't mean that healthy people with an intact gallbladder will have the same experience. So, and indeed, a lot of different studies have shown that high protein diets don't reduce kidney function in healthy people, and they don't even reduce kidney function in populations that are generally at risk for kidney disease, like people with dyslipidemia or obesity or hypertension. So, yes, if you have chronic kidney disease, particularly later stage chronic kidney disease, you don't want to eat a high protein diet, but that doesn't mean you need to avoid red meat. It just means you need to avoid eating red meat and other protein in excess of 0.7 grams per pound per day or 1.5 grams per kilogram per day. I think that's it. for this question.
Okay. Well, I think you covered it pretty in depth there. So do we have time for one more question?
Let's do the CoQ10 question.
Okay. So Carrie asks, if you haven't already, would you speak about CoQ10 levels with paleo nutrition and your opinion of supplementing with it? I.e., do CoQ10 levels decrease with age the same as the general population? Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one that I get fairly regularly, actually. CoQ10, it's found in most cells, primarily in the mitochondria, and it's a component of the electron transport chain, and it participates in aerobic cellular respiration, which is generating energy in the form of ATP. So I don't know if y'all remember back to your high school biology class and ATP, the Krebs cycle, citric acid cycle, and ATP production, ATP being the fundamental energy unit of the cell. This is what we're talking about here. And 95% of the human body's energy is actually generated this way. So it's a very important process. You can think of CoQ10 kind of like the spark plug in a car. And without that initial spark that CoQ10 supplies, the body can't function properly. CoQ10 deficiency can produce not only subjective signs of low energy and fatigue, but all kinds of different, you know, the range of symptoms that it can produce is vast because ATP fuels cellular energy production, and cellular energy production is what makes the body function properly. So if you're CoQ10 deficient, a lot can go wrong. And CoQ10 can exist in three redox states. It can be fully oxidized, as ubiquinone. It could be a semiquinone as semiquinone, and then fully reduced in the ubiquinol form. And this enables it to perform functions both of energy production in the electron transport chain that I mentioned, and also it can function as an antioxidant. And when it does that, CoQ10 inhibits lipid peroxidation, so the oxidation of fatty acids by preventing the production of lipid peroxyl radicals. So that's a lot of scientific mumbo jumbo, but basically the thing that most people need to understand about CoQ10 is that it plays a crucial role in energy production, and it plays a crucial role in preventing oxidative damage. So lately in my patient population, I've been doing some urine organic acids testing. And one of the things that shows up on that test is several different markers for CoQ10 deficiency. And I would say probably 80 to 85% of people that I test with the organic acids test are CoQ10 deficient. Some are severely, really high. And I think that's probably can be explained by the level of oxidative stress that most of us are living with in the modern lifestyle. There's a lot of oxidative stress that we're subject to, and CoQ10 would be depleted in those conditions.
Is there any?
There are also. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, is there any patterns that you see? Is it gender or age?
Well, age, CoQ10 production tends to decline with age. So I've seen some statistics that suggest that by the time we're 50, we have half the amount of CoQ10 that we had when we were 20 years old. So it's simply aging can decrease CoQ10 levels, but we experience oxidative stress as we age. So I don't, you know, I don't know if that's not an underlying mechanism, but it's just something to be aware of. And then there are genetic factors that can also lead to CoQ10 deficiency, because the biosynthesis of CoQ10 requires at least 12 different genes and mutations, and many of them can cause CoQ10 deficiency. I don't do a lot of that kind of genetic testing, but I have some colleagues that have done that, and apparently those mutations in those genes are not uncommon. CoQ10, as many people know, shares a biosynthetic pathway with cholesterol. So the synthesis of mevalonate, which is an intermediary precursor of CoQ10, is inhibited by some drugs like beta blockers in particular, and blood pressure lowering drugs, and of course statins. Statins inhibit the production of cholesterol and CoQ10. And that's why statins have been shown to reduce serum levels of CoQ10 by up to 40%. So anybody who's taking a statin should absolutely be taking CoQ10. That's just a no-brainer. And unfortunately, I think the awareness for this is increasing in the general medical community, and I think a lot of doctors even recommend it now. But if anyone knows someone who's taking a statin, or you're taking one yourself, that's definitely something you should speak to them about, or you should be doing. And if you have CoQ10 deficiency, whether you're on a statin or not, supplementing is a really good idea. There's a couple of things I want to point out regarding CoQ10 supplementation. Number one, despite a lot of claims by supplement manufacturers, there's no solid evidence that ubiquinol is a superior form to supplement with than ubiquinone, which is the cheaper form that's been used for decades in the research. And I've never seen any study that has convinced me that ubiquinol is better to use. So just stick with the ubiquinone. The main factors that determine CoQ10 absorption is whether you eat it with fat, because CoQ10 is fat soluble. So whenever you take a CoQ10 supplement, you should always take it with a meal that includes some fat, or just a snack that has some fat. And then there are certain forms of CoQ10, certain delivery mechanisms, I guess you could say, that have been shown to be better absorbed than others. And there's one called the Kanika, or Kanika, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Q-absorb process. It's a proliposome lipid-soluble delivery system. And that makes sense, because CoQ10 is fat-soluble, right? So that's been shown in one study to increase CoQ10 levels up to 400% from baseline. The one product that I will often recommend is Gero Q-Sorb, that uses this Kanika Q-Absorb delivery mechanism, and it's pretty affordable. I don't see any need to buy anything fancier than that. And the dosage can vary a lot, but generally, with a mild deficiency, mild to moderate deficiency, 60 to 120 milligrams a day is a good starting place.
This is interesting, because I've looked into this before. Once you start supplementing with this, do you build the levels back up in the body, or is this something that if you're under oxidative stress and you're on a paleo diet, you're going to be taking the supplement part of your daily regimen for a while?
I think you kind of answered the question to some extent in asking it. It depends on how you're able to alter the things that led to the CoQ10 deficiency in the first place, right? If you have a genetic mutation, there's not too much that you're going to be able to do about that, probably. So some people may need to take CoQ10 indefinitely. They just might feel better on it, more energy, body might function better. People who are dealing with significant levels of oxidative stress, of course, the recommendation there would be to take steps to reduce oxidative stress. And then if that's possible, it's possible in that case to get off the CoQ10. Some people, I think, going back to the analogy we used before with histamine, I think taking CoQ10 for a therapeutic period of time and repleting CoQ10 levels is enough to get things functioning properly again, and then you can discontinue maybe after 3 to 6 months or something like that. And that doesn't rule out the possibility that you might need to start taking it again at some point. But generally, I consider 3 to 6 months to be a kind of a therapeutic window for repleting levels of CoQ10 or any nutrient that's been depleted. And then, of course, if somebody's on a statin, for as long as they're taking a statin or any other drug that's known to inhibit CoQ10, then they'll have to continue taking the CoQ10. So it really depends on the circumstances.
Okay. Thanks for clearing that up. Last question about this. If, say, you don't have access to some organic acid testing, you're not taking a statin, you're just doing paleo and trying to live a healthy life, is there any sort of symptoms that might indicate that I'm likely to be CoQ10 deficient?
It's pretty hard to make that determination just with symptoms because a lot of the symptoms are so nonspecific. I would say fatigue is probably one of the biggest ones, particularly, I mean, fatigue on exertion, like getting tired more quickly than you think you should. Muscle fatigue could be another one because CoQ10 is involved in energy production, the muscles. So if your muscles are getting really fatigued, even after short periods of activity, that's another one. So, cardiovascular issues, because the tissues that have the highest energy needs are the ones that have the highest levels of CoQ10, like the heart. So, the organic acids test, though, it's pretty accessible. It's not too expensive. It's like $180 for the basic version. They have Geneva Labs does one, Metametrics does one, which is the one that I use. I think even now, someone told me the other day that there are some websites now that you can order the tests through without having a clinician. I'm not sure what they are. Maybe I shouldn't mention which one, but maybe I can find that out for the future. I do, however, recommend working with a clinician, particularly with that test. It's pretty complicated to interpret, and oftentimes patients are pretty overwhelmed when they see the results, and it takes quite a bit of interpretation and explaining, because even when you see that something is deficient or in excess on that test, it doesn't tell you why. And that's where you need some deeper understanding of the mechanisms involved in the connections to be able to figure out why those things are deficient, so that you don't end up just taking a million different pills because the test says you should.
That is the key, working with somebody who's seen the patterns.
Yeah, I mean, an example is that something that tends to come up a lot on that organic acids test is a marker for biotin deficiency. And what is usually the case in that situation is that someone has gut dysbiosis. Why? Because biotin is produced by the intestinal bacteria. And so if you don't have enough of the type of intestinal bacteria that produces biotin, or you have an imbalance, a gut dysbiosis, that's probably in part what's contributing to the biotin deficiency, rather than a decrease in not eating enough biotin in the diet, although that's possible too. So in that situation, you'd want to address the gut dysbiosis primarily, and then secondarily probably supplement with biotin for a particular period, but you really need to get to the underlying cause.
Wow, you are just a resource of information. That's awesome.
I'm a geek, as you know, Steve. That's what I spend my time doing.
That's so much more. We don't even know. You might have like a Batman call, like a light or something out there in California. I'm gonna look more into this. I might travel out there and do some research.
Yeah, come on out and say hi. All right, we did it. We did a Q&A episode.
Yeah. We got all the way through it.
Yeah, we got lots of great questions lined up. There's some other ones that we hope to get to today, but we have them on the list, and we'll continue to get to them in the future episodes. So thanks for your patience.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening. We're going to send Chris on his vacation, and I'm hopefully going to send you over to chriscresser.com to use the podcast submission link and send us more questions. And also, if you've enjoyed the show today, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review.